Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
Jack Kerouac's 1957 novel, On the Road, is thought of as one of the defining works of the Beat Generation. It's a loosely autobiographical story of his journeys across the country in post-war America. The filmmaker Yves Bruneau says the book became a blueprint for the way many people think about hitting the road and finding freedom. In his documentary, Bruneau tells the story of Kerouac in his book, and he also profiles modern Americans who have taken to the road themselves. And one of the things that comes up in the film is this myth of how Kerouac wrote it, how he taped together these sheets of tracing paper, some 120 feet long, and he fed them into his typewriter like a scroll so he could keep the words flowing in a process of spontaneous prose. The Kerouac scholar Jean-Christophe Clotier is in the film, and he says this was actually a deliberate method of writing. It was rooted in rhythm and jazz and Kerouac's own bilingual background. But the idea that he was just pecking away at the keys, that the book was formless and written without intention, that's the myth some in the literary establishment were reacting to. They dismissed On the Road as hippie self-indulgence, as meandering and incoherent. Truman Capote put it this way: that's not writing, it's typing. Here's Clotier.
What's always struck me as ironically funny about that quip is that it might be accurate in the sense that Kerouac had already written the bulk of what became On the Road in his notebooks and road logs and diaries. And then he surrounded himself, as he always did for his whole career, with his notebooks and his archives and his notes, and sat at the typewriter and threaded the narrative tale together in one scroll. So it was a typing session in one way, in the sense that the writing had been done. But for Capote, it was a takedown, a way to say that this person has no writerly craft, probably does not do research, has not spent some time trying to refine his writing practice. And Kerouac had done that. There's also a funny story of Kerouac meeting Capote again in the wake of that quip. This was late in Kerouac's career when he went to the William Buckley show, and he was on the way to the set. And Truman Capote was in the same building, also getting ready for a TV show. And he was in the makeup chair. And Kerouac noticed him in the room and went inside and went right to him. And apparently Capote was a little dismayed and possibly even afraid. He was like, hey, what's going on? And Kerouac got really close to him. And he said, hey, I heard what you said about me there in the press. And Capote said, well, yes, I was just joking around a little bit. And then Kerouac got really close, nose to nose, looked at him, kissed him on the forehead and said, okay, just don't do it again. I love that story because it shows the ultimate kindness of Kerouac, kind of a Buddhist lack of rancor and the singularly nonviolent way of life that he had, despite, you know, the appearance of the Beats as kind of these kind of jocks, or, you know, he was a football player, that kind of stuff. But in real life, he was, I think, quite kind and mild. And yet, Kerouac is a lifelong reader of the greats, you know, and he always compared himself to the greats in his notes from very early on, reading Victor Hugo, James Joyce, Faulkner, Dostoevsky, you know, just reading the literary greats and wanting to be in dialogue with them, trying to match their achievements with his new kind of what he called a luxuriantly subjective way of being realist about the world, focused through his own self, which, you know, is the microcosm of autofiction, autobiographical writing, which today dominates the contemporary literary scene. But he is very much aware of that tradition. And so, of course, he wants to be in dialogue with them and not merely dismissed as a typist.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the documentary film called Kerouac's Road, The Beat of a Nation. This is the latest in our film series. We're going to be screening it tonight in the new building at the Utah Film Center. And we should say the screening is sold out, but there are always no-shows, and you can get on a waiting list. We'll have more details about that here in a moment. We're going to be hearing from the film's director, Ibes Bruneau, here in a minute, but we're going to begin with something about Kerouac himself and where he was coming from when he took to the road. Here's Jean-Christophe Clouthier again.
I was lucky that I encountered Kerouac at the right time, I think, which is in adolescence, late adolescence and early 20s, where his particular blend of sophistication and naivete is perfect. He has this great enthusiasm for life. And that kind of anti-negativity around the world really resonated with me. I think, you know, when you're a teenager, you can often be a broody kind with the hormones raging. And basically On the Road opens with the narrator being absolutely infatuated with this new character that comes on the scene called Dean Moriarty, because he is always saying yes to everything, yes to life, yes to food, yes to cars, yes to sex, yes to everything. And everybody else, he says, was in the nightmare negative position of putting everything down. Mm-hmm. And for me, following that was... it just gave me this great burst of inspiration. I remember just with my friends, we all passed the book around, we read it, we were very inspired. Very inspired also by the whole Beat story of how these were friends. Yeah. And they wrote things, and they wrote for each other, and they couldn't get published. And then Ginsberg would say, you know, these are all published in heaven. And you give yourself this kind of boost of confidence, and you just go for it. And so we also went on adventures. Back in my bay, I hitchhiked the whole of Canada back in the day, and in a whole summer's worth, and ended up working on a farm out there in British Columbia, and climbing mountains, and learning how to do little blacksmithing, because there was a blacksmith on the farm. Let's learn how to do about blacksmithing. You know, just little weird, strange, unexpected things that way makes you discover life, makes you discover things you would never otherwise have seen if you had not gone on the road and had your own adventure.
What do we know about when Kerouac comes up with the idea of writing this book or something like this book? Like, where was he? Made me wonder, was it a book idea or was it an idea just to go on the road that started?
Well, I think it was both. I mean, he'd been wanting to be a writer as a vocation since 11 years old.
Yeah.
So he has that in his diaries, you know, all the way back from that he has kept. And so everything becomes a way to file his units, as he would say, because he was a lifelong archivist, file his units in the proper place. And some of the proper place was sometimes novels. And after The Town and the City, which is his first published novel in 1950, he felt he needed a wilder form, you know, to reflect some of the cross-country trips he had started to take in 47, 48, 49. So as he was writing Town and the City, he's also going through these trips. And the life experience refracts back onto his literary ambition to determine that, change it in its direction, that I'm going to have to match a new style for the new lifestyle that I'm experiencing. Part of it had to do also with wanting to capture the authenticity of the wildness of the road itself, the cadences of speech of his friends, like the great talker Neil Cassady that became, yes, the Dean Moriarty. How to capture in writing that velocity, that movement. And I think it's no coincidence that he needed a scroll, which when you unfurl it, looks like a road, to embody the very spirit of what he's trying to capture. And no matter what he was trying to write in the late 40s and early 50s, he didn't know what his second book was going to be, but he called everything On the Road. So whatever it was going to be, he wanted it to be called On the Road. Visions of Cody, what became Visions, was called On the Road. You know, all sorts of other books that became other things were at some point sometimes called On the Road. So he knew where he wanted to go with it.
What did Kerouac want to understand about the country? I mean, he says that he wanted to know it as I know the palm of my hand. And one of the things you've talked about is what he was trying to understand, at least in part, was he wanted to understand this country because he came to it with this immigrant sensibility. Will you talk about that?
Absolutely. I mean, that line is from Seymour Crimm. Yeah. And he said that only someone with immigrant sensibilities could write this book, meaning that you're so enchanted with what you encounter as a sense of novelty and wonder that you need to go and actually discover more of it. And the United States, America, is not just a nation, it's like a whole continent. And so he's from a family that migrated into the United States. His grandfather, Jean-Baptiste Kerouac, with his father, who was still a child at the time, migrated into New England in search for work, in search of a better life, because they were destitute and then the farm was no longer producing. And so he grows up with in French as the language of the home, but also, you know, as this the homeland, the ancestral land being Canada, being Quebec. And so the food, the language, the customs, everybody's talking about this all the time at the family reunions. It's like with any kind of dual culture immigrant kind of family story in the U.S., which is itself a quintessential American story, right? The immigrant story. But so he had that sense of needing to discover not just the land and the people, but even the language and the sound. I think that's why he's so fascinated with sound, with jazz, with music. But, you know, the cadences of a Mississippi gym, right? All the characters inside the novel that come from different areas, the Mexican migrant workers that he travels with for a whole season, for instance. He's charmed by the musicality of it all. And he has that naive and yet exuberant curiosity to get to know the other and wanting to create a kinship within this encounter.
So the book is centered on Sal and Dean, which are just character names for Jack himself and his friend, the writer Neil Cassady. Why not just say their names, his own name, you know, and Neil's name? What do you understand about the way he's putting that together? And what do you understand about the relationship, this element of love and homoeroticism between Jack Kerouac and Neil Cassady?
Sure. I mean, he did write it with the real name. You know, the scroll has Neil. You know, I first met Neil not long after my father died. That's the first real line. I first met Dean not long after my wife and I split up.
Right. So why change?
Well, in part, that's a legal question. Publisher fears, you know, we don't want to get sued. We have to change the names, make sure nobody can get this back to us. That's part of it. So there was definitely that fear in the 50s from the publisher's standpoint, because there was too much sex, too much drugs, too many of all those things that could have legal repercussions. There's a lot of other kind of revisions that he did over the years as well. Thankfully today, you know, since 2007, I believe, we can read the original scroll if we want to. He never publicly kind of admitted or talked about his homosexual gay experiences at all, I think. But I was doing research this past summer at the Harry Ransom Center. They have a beautiful Cassady and Kerouac collection. And there was a postcard sent to Neil Cassady. And all it said, you know, if you turn it around, it was three words: I love you. And it was, you know, it shook me up. I was kind of emotional seeing that. It was such a simple, but just, you know, to take the time to send that one postcard and you just say, I love you, you know. And I think he did love him. I think he was attracted to him as well, you know, physically. Yeah. They had a kind of soul brotherhood at the same time. They became very, very close. And fascinatingly to me, you know, in his longest French novel, Sur le Chemin, which means On the Path, he wrote that novel as a prequel to On the Road. And it's an imaginary, apocryphal meeting of the Neil character and the Jack character as children, as 10 years old, Neil being 9 and he being 10. And they meet and they discover that through intermarriage, they actually are cousins. So they're blood relations in a way. And I think he wanted to do that in the symbolic structure of his oeuvre to be actually linked familially, you know, as a familial link with this individual that he, you know, bonded with so much. I often call On the Road a bromance. I think it's a true bromance in that way. And it's not to diminish the beauty of friendship as well, you know, of male friendship. Again, I'm not dismissing that he had the hots for him too, but there is something beautiful about friendship, you know. When there's a moment in On the Road when everybody's against Dean because of all the damage he's created in so many relationships. And Sal tells him, remember, I believe in you.
you know, in a moment when no one else does. And that's what a friend can do for you sometimes. And I think there's a lot of that that I also kind of admire in the book.
That's Jean-Christophe Clotier. He's an associate professor of English and comparative literature at the University of Pennsylvania. He's in the documentary Kerouac's Road, The Beat of a Nation, which we're going to be screening tonight in partnership with the Utah Film Center. Now, the screening is sold out, but you can get on a wait list at the event. We'll have details on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're continuing our film series, our partnership with Utah Film Center. We're talking about the unruly, restless writer Jack Kerouac and his search to know America in his book On the Road. The filmmaker Ibes Bruneau has a documentary that traces Kerouac's life and his road trips that shaped a generation. It's a film about how Kerouac's questions of freedom and belonging still echo today. And Bruneau shows modern Americans hitting the road, searching for that freedom and connection. A young college-bound traveler, a woman who has set out to reunite with her father, and a couple, Tinashe and Tino, who are cruising the country in their Sprinter van. The film is called Kerouac's Road, The Beat of a Nation. Back now to our conversation with the Kerouac scholar Jean-Christophe Clotier. One of the things that comes up in the film is, and Jay McInerney talks about how much of a contradictory figure Kerouac was. He's on the road, experimenting, but he's also a mama's boy. He's also a devout Catholic. There's this quote from Kerouac I remember. He said, "I'm not a beatnik, I'm a Catholic." One of the stories that comes up in the film is, he joined the Merchant Marine, believed that if he survived during the war, that it was meant to be, that he was destined by God to survive. Talk about what you see in that sort of contradictory nature of Kerouac.
When he joined the Merchant Marine, he changed his name because he says, "You can't join the Merchant Marine with a name like Gene." So like, in a way, you have to be somebody else. You have to be more masculine in a way, right? Because Gene in English sounds like it's a woman's name, whereas in French it's Jean.
Jean, yeah.
And yes, on one of his first televised appearances, when the host was trying to get him to say something, cliched about beat culture or something, yeah. And he asked him, like, "What do you want out of life? What are you waiting for?" And Kerouac said, "I'm waiting for God to show His face." And like, the guy just didn't know what to say to that. Right? What do you say to that?
Yeah.
Like, there's a depth or a spirituality there, but I think it's elusive. And what do you say to that?
It may have been informed by having had something to drink too, which was always a part of those conversations, it seems.
Yes, for sure. Yeah. I mean, he was very shy, very nervous, and in The Night Is My Woman, his first French novel that he wrote just before writing The Stroll of On the Road, he wrote it just a couple of weeks before. He talks about this first time he ever had a beer, and he said it was like encountering the good Lord. Now, if you have an experience of the divine when you have alcohol, you're going to keep drinking, right? Yeah. And, I think he had seen his father drink his whole life as well. So there is that relation there of the divine and alcohol in Kerouac, speaking of God and the Catholic. And so, yes, the beat for him had to have a spiritual facet, the beatitude, right? That beat is not just about rhythm and about being tired and about beaten down, but also about being beatific and seeking a kind of a relationship with God and spirituality. He's full of contradictions like that. He's a Buddhist, but he's also a lifelong Catholic.
Right? He's a mama's boy, but he's like a big sexual rebel on the road. Yeah. He's sedentary for when he writes, but he always needs to be on the move. He's someone who's changed American letters, but he's a native French speaker. Mm. So there's a lot of contradictions with it, but I think that's part of what makes him interesting. And part of what's real about Kerouac is that he's extremely complex, but he's been read by the establishment as way overly simplified and a kind of dunce. Thankfully, now his archive shows us the tremendous evidence of his craft and of his complexity when you can read through all the documents.
I want to come back to the that kind of the myth about how Kerouac wrote on the road, because you've already sort of talked about how he had, you know, written this in his journals. He had lots of notes already, done all the work, but then he sits down. And so he does tape together these sheets of tracing paper, right? And so just talk a little bit about the process. What's he getting at? Is it because he's wanting to type without interruption? I mean, it's said that he's trying to go for this idea of, you know, as it's put, spontaneous prose. He wants it to pour out of him as he remembered it. Like, what? Help us understand what actually he's going for and against the myth of what was happening.
Yeah, so this is when he gets the idea to do the scroll. Later, he'll use teletype paper and feed it into his typewriter so that he doesn't have to scotch tape anything. But this is when he gets the idea that I need something that will stop me from having to interrupt my thought. Yeah. He wanted to keep the flow going, in part because it had to do with the flow of the tale, of how when you tell someone a story, this is an anecdote he would often tell, or an analogy he would often use. Like when you're at the bar with your friends and you're telling a story, you don't suddenly stop and say, okay, wait, let me go back to 2 minutes ago. And kind of revise something. You just keep going. Mm. You tell your story. And he wanted to do that. He also wanted it to kind of to go fast and to look like a road. He writes that in his notes, like, it looks like a road. And he's extremely excited about that. That the topic, the content meets the very material object that it has produced. And so he kind of developed this kind of trance-like discipline where in the moments of, you know, complete inspiration, you would go into this ability to write spontaneous prose. Now, in terms of timing, it's important to remember that his actual breakthrough, quote-unquote, into spontaneous prose as a method came in October of 1951 when he was recovering from a bout of phlebitis in his legs at the Kingsbridge Veterans Hospital in the Bronx. That's when he realized, that's how I can do it, because the scroll was written in April of 1951. But the idea there of the scroll is that he wanted to keep going. And by the way, the scroll doesn't have like part one, chapter two, you know, part three, set chapter four. It's not separated like that. It's just one long story. He wanted that because that's also how we experience life, right? Like we can't pause life and fast forward as like we do with our TV shows or anything, right? We have to just go through it. And there's a lot of that experientialness of it, the telepathic shock to the reader. It became later a much more theorized and thought through method, especially after he wrote The Subterraneans in 1953 in 3 days, in October 21, 2023. And then he was so gaunt, apparently, and completely white as a sheet. He looked like he was going to collapse after the 3 days. And he had produced this typescript, and his friends Allen Ginsberg and William Burroughs asked, "How did you do this? What are you doing? What's your method?" And that prompt by his friends is what led to him composing The Essentials of Spontaneous Prose, and the this bullet point list of what you need to do to try to enact this discipline. And those two documents today are used often in creative writing departments or just people needing a kind of bout of inspiration, trying to go for it. And that's how he kind of started to spell it out in those documents. But earlier on, he hadn't quite cracked it, but he was touching the source. He was touching the source.
So he writes, finishes it, I guess, 1951, doesn't get it published until 57. Viking Press publishes it, but they wanted all these revisions to it. So this comes up in the film. Jay McInerney says that when he published it, it wasn't exactly the thing that he wanted it to be. How much did he compromise to get it published?
It's a good question. The thing is, he revised it over several years. Yeah. There are multiple revisions here. At some point, he called it the Beat Generation, because at that point, a little later on, the John Cleland Holmes's article had come out, and he wanted, it was kind of a known term suddenly, right? Mm. And when he submitted it to Alfred Knopf, for instance, the publisher, it was under the title The Beat Generation, and under the author name Jean-Louis, with no last name at all. He added some things that I think work really well. I personally think the revisions work quite well. Mm. I think he was frustrated with a lot of the punctuation that happened.
Yeah,
I don't believe he received the galleys for the last versions of punctuation changes, and that really angered him. Because it had to do with his flow, of course.
Right.
He ended up having to pay, I think, to redo some punctuation for the Dharma bombs, because he had a bit more clout there, but they still made him like pay the fee for, you know, the delays in the press or something. So, you know, there's a lot of things along the way that happened that he was forced and was not completely in his control. Mm. You know, it's funny, you know, the rejection by Knopf talks about how this novel has a gargantuan vitality, you know, with a scope and breathlessness, you know, real insight into this post-war generation. And for all these reasons, I believe we should reject it. It's like, what? You know, it's unbelievable as a document to read it. For the reasons that it will become a sensation are the same reasons why a more conservative press is like, let's not go there.
Well, it does become a sensation, and it gets to something that a story that's told in the film. This New York Times review, Gilbert Milstein reviews it on September 5th, 1957. He calls it an historic occasion, says it's going to be the novel of the Beat Generation. And Kerouac is, I think, stunned is the word that comes up a lot. Well, talk about his reaction to it, because he says it made his career, but then it ruined his life.
Yes, that's right. I mean, Joyce Johnson, who was his partner at the time when that came out, she says that he might have been a little bit afraid of it, too, that there was a bit of fear in seeing that review. And once she also told me that he looked up at her and said, it's good, right? Like in the sense of this kind of disbelief that finally something might actually be good. As a review for this poor man who had been rejected for so many years. You have to understand that by now he's 35 years old, and he the year before he had written this list of all the works that he has written in his archive. And he called that list, if he can be called a failure, one who leaves 1.5 million unpublished words at 32, you know? And so if he can be called a failure, right? He has a vocation. He keeps writing through the rejection. But is he a failure? He can't get anything published, you know? And so, or only these excerpts, like in New World Writing in 55. And then another excerpt in Paris Review, The Mexican Girl, it was called, you know? But that was before people knew that this was part of something called On the Road that would become this other thing. So when it does come out, I think he is surprised. And yes, the other thing to know about Kerouac is at that point, he had moved on from the kind of style and approach of the novel to much more experimental type of novels like Dr. Sacks, Maggie Cassidy, Visions of Cody. And he had kind of not only moved away from, you know, being a young 20-something on the road, he was moving away into these more radical kind of literary forms. Mm-hmm. And then to suddenly become this avatar of a generation that he already felt kind of he no longer belonged to came as quite a shock. You know, Big Sur, the novel Big Sur, dramatizes that shock in very stark ways. And the real damage that it did on him, the plunge into alcoholism. You know, he says, like, you know, here I am. Everybody thinks Jack Kerouac is 26 years old and hitchhiking on the road. But here I am with my little pre-made sandwiches hiding in a train-bound cat, you know. And so it was a shock because he was not prepared to be this avatar.
Yeah. Well, his health deteriorates, of course. But 1969, he's just 47. He dies of hemorrhaging, connected to the drinking, of course, the years of heavy drinking. So it's this really kind of sad, tragic end to this life that was powered by all this endless motion. What do you make of his end?
I find it incredibly sad, you know, in the sense that he was, you know, I feel that the establishment and the reviews injected so much like mainline poison and venom into his bloodstream that, you know, he just retreated more and more and more into alcoholism. And then the diminished returns of it on his own writing capacity also kind of came in tandem with that. I think he was greatly misunderstood. I think if he had explained from the beginning that he was actually Jean-Louis Kerouac from a bilingual household and that he was not a native speaker, people would have already started to say, hey, maybe there's something more complex and interesting about this person. I mean, today that would be a kind of exoticism or whatever that publishers would jump on to kind of advertise their wares rather than a kind of myth, Jack Kerouac, you know, football player, here he is, look how handsome he is, you know, kind of thing. And so I think it's part of what's sad is that he did end up having such an impact across the globe in translation and in Quebec. You know, he's beloved in Quebec and in so many places he's beloved and admired. But he didn't get that memo. You know, that's a posthumous memo that he didn't quite get in time. And that brings sadness to me in the sense of because of the gift. Like, that's the thing. Because he's that companion, because he gives you telepathic shock, meaning excitement, because so many people call him Jack, you know, he's your friend, but nobody kind of came back and told him how much of a friend he had continued to be to so many. And, you know, that would have been nice. But, you know, that happened to Melville, too. You know, poor guy died a customs agent in New York, but now he's a master, you know.
You had talked about finding On the Road at the right time in your adolescence. So I guess the obvious question is, does it still hold up? And do you worry that young people will know it? Because it can seem dated. The language is, you know, problematic as treatment of women and kind of racist terms. And so what do you make of that, the idea of its relevance? Does it hold up?
I think so. I mean, but you have to have your own understanding of it. I think Mr. Bell explains it quite well in the documentary when he says, look, I know this is from the 1950s. I know when it's from. And if I want to know about that time and place, I can go in this book and it's almost like an ethnography. But I'm not going to, you know, absolve it of all of its sins or all of the terribleness that can lurk within in the, as James Baldwin called it, offensive nonsense that it also contains. But I think it brings you back to that experience and the exuberance of a young narrator as he feels it, right? Like, as he says in the novel, all I have to offer is nothing but my own confusion, right? And there's that honesty again. I'm just going to offer you my confusion. This is me in my confused state. You know, take it or leave it. And there's no answers. It's just a lot of questions. You know, like, are you guys going somewhere or just going? Someone asks him that. And he says, well, that was a damn good question, right? Are we going somewhere or just going? I still teach it today, you know. Some students go for it right away. Some have more reservations. If you are able to look past some of the things that seem offensive to you in your reading, there is something else going on too. There's an attempt at reaching a kind of kinship. There's an attempt at getting to know another, not necessarily with the great skill of getting to know that other and formulating in the right way what the other means to you or somebody else, but there is a genuine searching there that I think humans still can relate to. So it holds up in its own way, and it'll continue to mean something different for different generations. And, you know, one man's belly laugh is another's religion, right? And so our reactions change depending on our own upbringing, if we are from somewhere else, if we're from a different country, if we're, you know, all sorts of things. And so that diversity also is a diversity of response to the same text. It's not a kind of absolute truth in itself. It's somebody trying to convey something. And you take it or leave it, and you either show a kind of generosity to the other in their own flaws,
Or you say to yourself, you know what, I don't need any of this right now. And you walk away.
Jean-Christophe Cloutier, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Jean-Christophe Cloutier, he's an associate professor of English and comparative literature at the University of Pennsylvania. We're talking about the documentary Kerouac's Road, The Beat of a Nation, which we're going to be screening tonight at the Utah Film Center's new building. The screening is sold out, but you can get on a wait list at the event. Go to our website for details, radiowest.org. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from listeners like you. Become a member at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been talking about the documentary film called Kerouac's Road, The Beat of a Nation. This is the latest in our film series. We're screening it tonight in the new building for the Utah Film Center. Yves Bruneau directed the film. We talked to him earlier this week. And like Jean-Christophe, he also discovered On the Road at the right time, when he was an adolescent.
I first read it when I was probably, I want to say I was 16. And I remember classmates and friends who it really resonated with. And I remember it didn't resonate with me that strongly in the sense that I couldn't relate to it. And yet I was fascinated by it. You know, going on the road for me was still, you know, I would still, when I was 8, 9, 10, my mother and I would drive from northern Florida, from Tallahassee, down to visit my grandmother in Fort Lauderdale. And there were places, this is 1988, 89, 90.
Yeah.
There were places on that drive that you knew you didn't stop to have lunch, or you knew you didn't stop to fill up your gas tank because they weren't safe. There was a lot of bigotry in those, in certain communities going through. You just didn't feel safe as a young single Black woman with this young Black kid in a car driving, and you just didn't take any chances. So this idea that I could be reading about this guy who literally was just driving across America for, you know, 7 years and just doing all sorts of things was something I couldn't relate to. And yet I'm a student even then, and have been my whole life, of American history, a student of American politics. And so I couldn't be someone who loved and cared about all of those things and not read the book and say, wow, this is about my country, even though I can't relate to every road trip.
Kerouac says that On the Road is a book about America. This is how he put it, as we see in your film. The America I want to know, the America of the road. What did he mean by that? The America that he wants to know, the America of the road. What is America in that sense?
You know, Kerouac, this was a person who, because of his Franco-Canadian background and because he didn't speak English until he was 6 or 7 years old, you know, really never felt, even though he looked the part, he never really felt like an American. He never felt like he owned America in that way, and that it belonged to him and he belonged to it. You know, I think for me, as that young Black gay kid in the American South, not feeling like you could stop in this town to get gas or in this town to have lunch on your way to see Granny, I started to find that he felt like an outsider. And so he was very much in search of how did he fit in? Where did he fit in this place? And to understand it, he felt he needed to go out and see the vastness of it.
Yeah.
And I think it was a discovery. And by the way, I say to people all the time, America's, it's just gigantic.
Yeah.
We forget about how big it is as Americans.
One of the questions that the comic and journalist Camo Bell asks in your film is, you know, is this the great American novel?
I mean, I think there is a narrative in America about exploration. So, you know, you've heard the phrase, go west, young man. It's like looking out, the dream is over there. He sort of laid down, this is the way I did it, now you do it your way. So I think absolutely it is one of the foundational texts for discovering America or discovering things outside of yourself.
It is true. Americans hold a sense of independence, and there is a sense of adventure. And it goes back, I think, to the size. It goes back to not knowing what's beyond that mountain range. And oh, wait, we got over it, and there's more. Oh, and there's an ocean. Oh, now we're at the end. Oh, but wait, there was a lake in the middle that we thought was an ocean. And all of that, the vastness, the sense of adventure, it has all laddered up and created what has long been and remains a sense of American exceptionalism within our country in terms of never feeling limited. Limitless possibilities, even though there may be limits, it's still like, I can get ahead if I just forge forward. If I just get on the road and go to the next town, it can be done. And that is uniquely American.
Mm. The film has these portraits of people who are on the road. Let's talk about a few of them. Tell us about Diana.
After my first road trip and I fell in love with life on the road, I really did consider becoming a truck driver.
Why didn't you?
I was busy adulting with other things. I had a good business, and at the time I figured I needed to make a living more than I needed to be free. But now that I'm retired, I can pretty much do whatever I want and go wherever I want. And that's a really nice feeling.
Diana is extraordinary. She, a single woman, has lived pretty much on the road in her camper van with her dog.
Yeah.
And she left home basically as soon as she turned 18 and had a very difficult relationship with her father and an abusive relationship with her father,
yeah.
Physical abuse, and went away and has made a decision that, you know, her father, who at the time was in his 90s, she felt like she wanted to go back and say goodbye on her terms.
Her relationship with her father is, as you say, conflicted. She waited until she retired to set out on the road. So the idea of there being a journey, a process, as we see her throughout the film, I guess is important.
Yes. Look, Kerouac was also reminding us that we're all on our own individual journey. Mm. Look, when I say that one of the few things that binds us all together is the road, it's also that we're all on it. Mm. And we're going to bump into one another. And that's some of the stuff that makes life exciting. And it's part of what makes things in our ever-increasing digital world. It's what still gives us humanity and makes us human. But Diana's journey is one that was, you know, she's 70 years old. It was a journey that, you know, I think she says it in the film, she'd seen her parents four times in 50 years.
Yeah.
This was a journey of a lifetime for her, both the physical of going back as well as, you know, metaphorically.
Another part of what the film does is get at the effect of on the road, on people's lives, people we don't know, but also people we do. Matt Dillon's in there, Natalie Merchant's in there. The actor Josh Brolin is one of these people. And Brolin says something interesting. He says, it's one of those books, I mean, it clearly profoundly affected, it changed his life, he says. And it's interesting when he also mentions early on in the film that he's not sure he wants to go back and reread it.
I think On the Road had the impact that it was supposed to have, and I like the impact in hindsight. I don't know if I want to reread it because the impact was so massive to me. I have the original book that I had when I was 19, and it changed my life. I mean, it really did. It changed my life. I loved that whole idea that I got from Kerouac of just like hopping in a boxcar and just going.
I personally think that for Josh, I understand completely why he wouldn't want to reread it, because, you know, he was kind of such a, you know, he was on his motorcycle at a young age. He was had the wind in his hair at, you know, 18, 17, mm-hmm. riding through the mountains. And, you know, it is that ultimate adventure. You look at, I mean, even when I, you know, you reading it and you're like, oh my God, I'm far too old to sleep in a car. My back is really aching from a run 2 days ago. The idea that I would be like, you know, hitchhiking in the middle of a rainstorm yeah. in Iowa is so unappealing. All these things that when you're of a certain age are adventures mm. and are exciting. And so I think if you, for people who perhaps looked at the book in that way, I completely understand that it's such an idealistic thing that you don't want to ruin it with the reality and the knowledge of age.
What did you learn about the country by going on the road? One of the things you've talked about is that we're in a country that's siloed, and so getting out there seems to get beyond that. But you also have talked about seeing the bumper stickers at the RV parks. You want to talk about that?
You know, the bumper stickers were interesting. You know, you could be, you know, you're at an RV park and there's a bumper sticker that says, you know, I hate Trump, next to a bumper sticker at the time that said, I hate Biden.
Yeah.
You know, what it's a great reminder of is that there is more that binds us than tears us apart. There is more shared. I've always known that about America. It was good being back on the road, having that reintroduction in that way, that reminder, because those different political opinions can still, you know what they're talking about? They're talking about where the cheapest gas is
yeah.
at X66. They're right, talking right. about, you know, where to get a great porterhouse steak. And it was also interesting for me because I hadn't spent a lot of time in RV parks. And so that was also a really fun and cool and eye-opening thing, because these are, especially in a post-COVID world,
yeah.
these became, they always were, but in with COVID, they were outdoor communities where, you know, I was at one place where they were like, okay, like, you know, the pool and the jacuzzi are over here. I was like, oh, this, you know, the general store is here. But you find that what people are consistently craving is a sense of community.
Let me ask you finally. Josh Brolin says in the film that you won't live a full life until you put yourself on the firing line. And I think what he's saying is, unless you get out there.
You're reading the book and you're going, these are interesting people. I want an interesting life. You know, where is the community? Where is the longing? Where is the romance, the broken romance? Where is the loneliness? Where is all of it? And that's what I had gotten from on the road.
I think getting out on the road in the physical sense is essential. You know, I say the country's siloed. You know what? It forces the person with the I hate Trump bumper sticker to park next to the person with the I hate Biden bumper sticker.
Yeah.
It forces you to interact in a way that in today's society, we don't have to interact with people that we might not run into as much, because we all go to this same church and the same school and the same Cub Scout meeting. And we can easily find ourselves in an echo chamber where we're only talking to people who think like we do, or look like us, or sound like us, or, you know, read what we read, or listen to the music we listen to. So I think, regardless of what we're fed by social media or media writ large, there is so much more that brings us together than that tears us apart. And I think the more we get out of ourselves and talk to the person at the supermarket and, you know, have a lunch with a colleague that listens to a different radio station than you listen to, the more likely we are to just genuinely being happy.
Yves Bruneau, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Doug.
Yves Bruneau, he directed the documentary Kerouac's Road, The Beat of a Nation, which we're screening tonight at the Utah Film Center. And we should say the screening is sold out, but if you're interested in coming, you can get on a first-come, first-served wait list at the event. You can find details on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on YouTube at KUER90.1. We're on Instagram at Radio West. And you can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. Aidan Oneida is our intern. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. I'm Doug Fabrizio.